Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Today, a defense of teachers. You know, education, the institution, has long been in the political crosshairs, but in recent years, that criticism has changed from macro to micro. Teachers themselves have been subject to criticism and overheated political rhetoric. My guest today reminds us of the true calling that most teachers share and reminds us of the awesome responsibility teachers have, how we should all value that more. Taylor Malley is a poet and former classroom teacher. He's the author of the internet viral poem, What Teachers Make. And he's now written a book that amplifies the thematic elements of his poem. It's titled, What Teachers Make, in Praise of the Greatest Job in the World. It's published by Putnam. Taylor Malley is a New York City performance poet these days and has been featured on HBO's Deaf Poetry Jam and has won the National Poetry Slam Championship 4 times. He joins us today to talk about What Teachers Make here on Studio Tulsa. Taylor Malley, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Rich, it's my pleasure.
If you would start by reading your poem, What Teachers Make.
He says, the problem with teachers is what's a kid going to learn from someone who decided that his best option in life was to become a teacher? He reminds the other dinner guests that, you know, it's true what they say about teachers. Those who can, do, and those who can't, teach. I decide to bite my tongue instead of his and resist the urge to remind the other dinner guests that it's also true what they say about lawyers, because we're eating, after all, and this is supposed to be polite conversation. I mean, you're a teacher, Taylor. Come on, be honest. What do you make? And I wish he hadn't done that. Asked me to be honest, because you see, I've got this little policy in my classroom about honesty and butt-kicking, which is, if you ask for it, well, then I have to let you have it. You want to know what I make? I make kids work harder than they ever thought they could. I can make a C-plus feel like a Congressional Medal of Honor, and I can make an A-minus feel like a slap in the face. How dare you waste my time with anything less than your very best? I make kids sit through 40 minutes of study hall in absolute silence. No, you may not ask me a question. No, you cannot work in groups. Why won't I let you go to the bathroom? Because you're bored, and you don't really have to go to the bathroom, do you? I make parents tremble in fear when I call home at around dinner time. Hi, this is Mr. Malley. Hope I haven't called at a bad time. I just wanted to talk to you about something that your son said today in class to the biggest bully in the grade. He said, hey, why don't you leave that kid alone? I still cry sometimes, don't you? And that was the noblest act of courage that I have ever seen. I make parents see their children for who they are and who they can be. You want to know what I make? I make kids wonder. I make them question. I make them criticize. I make them apologize and mean it. I make them write, 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 and then I make them read. I make them spell. Definitely beautiful, definitely, beautiful, until they will never misspell either one of those words again. I make them show all their work in math class and then hide it on their final drafts in English. I make them realize that if you've got this up here, then you follow this in here. And if somebody ever tries to judge you based on what you make, you give them this right here. Here, let me break it down for you so you know what I say is true. Teachers make a difference. Now, what about you?
That's a great poem.
Thank you.
This came off a real incident, did it not?
All my poems are based in truth. This one is based in a little more truth than most. It wasn't a dinner party, but it was a New Year's Eve party in 1997, and there was several lawyers there, and I don't remember exactly how he asked the question. I'm almost positive he did not phrase it, what do you make? He probably said, come on, Taylor, be honest, you know, what's your salary, you know? But the point was clear, that anyone who was stupid enough to become a teacher was obviously not smart enough to be allowed to be one in the first place. And I certainly didn't have the wherewithal to come up with anything that even remotely sounded like the poem that in the next week or two became What Teachers Make. The poem is, to a certain extent, Rich, what I wish I had been able to say to him then. But that night at that New Year's Eve party, when he insulted me and the entire teaching profession, I probably said, $27,500.
That's a relatively new attitude, I think, in our society. Teachers used to be venerated, even and really respected for the fact that they were giving service. That culture seems to be changing. Why do you suppose that is?
I mean, I can go off and wax upon the greedy capitalistic society that is squeezing every penny of blood out of the workers, and it has now turned its relentless gaze onto public service sector employees, and teachers are part of that. But I don't know. I think it's the economy, and people need someone to blame. We can't really blame parents for their shortcomings as parents, and teachers are often the next closest caregiver, so perhaps they get the blame that way. But the real answer to your question is, I'm not sure.
Mm-hmm. Well, your book, What Teachers Make, which starts with a poem, but also offers a variety of, I guess I would call them meditations on the attributes that you talk about from this poem. Now, you've been living as a poet for the last few years. You've spent quite a bit of time as a classroom teacher, but you've been out of the classroom for a while. Why was it important to write this book now?
That's a good question. I wrote the poem during my last couple of years teaching in the classroom. But in June of 2000, I said goodbye to my last sixth grade homeroom class here in New York City just to see if I could pay the mortgage as a professional touring poet and teacher advocate. I think I wrote it now, to be perfectly honest, probably because I got the right invitation. The book is published with Putnam, and a very astute editor probably said, listen, I know you're a poet, and that's what you want to write, but if you really want to reach more people with this message, this love letter to teachers, why don't you tell us the story behind it? The poem's gone viral several times on YouTube, and it's actually been turned into what I call inspirational cyber spam. People forward the email, and they rewrite it, and you receive it in one of those emails you get from a friend where the subject begins with those ominous letters, FWD, and the email begins with, I don't normally do this, but I had to forward this piece. And so various iterations of the poem, some with my name attached to it, some rewritten and sanitized, and have been sent around the world for the last decade or so. And I sort of gave up trying to claim credit for the poem. Years ago, it used to be that once a week I would get an email from a fan saying, guess what our superintendent sent us around this morning? Don't worry, I let him know that you wrote the original. And I just figured, you know what, one of these days the truth will come out. And it was an editor at Penguin who said, well, why don't you help the truth come out and write me a book that sort of is the story behind the poem, the reflections, the teaching philosophy that went into the writing of every line, and also talking about what happened to the poem and how the poem has actually inspired people to become teachers. So that's what it is.
I was wondering if it had anything to do with the fact that over the last couple of years, we've seen these sort of attacks on teachers, whether it's in response to tight budgetary times in various states or this sort of institutional attack on teachers, whether it was in reaction to that.
That's probably her motivation. You know, yeah. I'm a poet, I'm an artist, but she's a publisher and she's a businesswoman. So she probably said, this is the time for you to write the book.
Yeah.
Let me go back and change my answer and say, Rich, it is because of the vicious attack on teachers. That's why this is the time to write the book.
Well, I guess you're the teacher. You can change the answer if you want.
No, that's the poet in me that's changing the answer.
Well, let's talk about some of the attributes that you talk about in this poem. And, of course, one that really strikes me is motivating students to achieve. You know, in this world that seems to value money and the ability to get more or less, that this would be a universally admired technique, because when teachers are talking to students, you're trying to get them to learn things from which there's no tangible financial reward that they can see in the long-term horizon. You can't punish them with losing your job, because either they have parents to support them or they don't have parents that can support them in an easy way. So you can't hurt them either way there. So the idea of teachers being able to motivate kids to achieve, this is like skills Fortune 500 companies are after.
Absolutely. In fact, you know, my degree, I went to Kansas State University for graduate school. I studied English literature and creative writing. So my first teaching job out of that was at a private school teaching math and history, of course. That's what you do with an English degree, right? You teach math. And but often teaching grammar or teaching how to turn a fraction into a percent, you know, students with calculators in their phones, calculators, when I was teaching, cell phones weren't as popular as they are today, but certain kids had calculators on their watches. They would say, if calculators are so prevalent, why do I need to know this? When am I ever going to need to know this in real life is a question that teachers often get asked. And I always think that there are two ways to answer that I can think of. One is always to say, what makes you think that this is not real life? You need to know this now. Real life is right now. I know you're living at home and your parents are, you know, you get to come here and to school for free and you won't understand how valuable this time is where you don't have to have all the responsibilities of adulthood. This is real life and you have to know this tomorrow on the quiz. That never works. That never works on a student. The better answer to tell them is this exact skill, how to turn a fraction into a decimal, or figuring out the seven reasons that the Roman Empire fell, or telling the difference between a gerund and a participle. These actual skills that I'm teaching you, this knowledge, when are you going to need to know this in real life? Never. Probably never. But you got to learn it now. And that's the lesson that I'm really teaching, is buckling down and doing what you have to do when you have to do it. Because that's what most of life is about. I don't want to do this, but I have to do this now. And so learning that you need to accomplish certain things that you don't want to accomplish, learning that you are tougher than you are. I had a friend who said the most important thing he learned in the Marine Corps was that he was much tougher than he thought he was. Mm-hmm. And one of the most important things that a teacher can teach, it's the first, when the poem turns, the first line is, you want to know what I make? I make kids work harder than they ever thought they could. And that's one of the things that a great teacher does, is say, is this your best? This better not be your best, because this is not good enough. Let's see how you can make it better. If it's not your best, why am I reading it? Ask any student, have you ever handed a paper in to a teacher and said, as you were handing it to them, this is terrible? And they often say, yeah, I've done that.
Yeah, no doubt.
Never do that. Never do that.
Right. One of the other things that was a wonderful chapter in this book was making telephone calls for witnessing good actions. There's nothing better for a kid is to hear the teacher talk to their parents about something good they did. That is something very special because the teacher talks to the parent relates to the child. That's something most teachers don't do, but you found it very rewarding to do that.
Yes, sir. I used to reserve Tuesday evenings. That would be the day that I would stay at school a little bit longer, and I would call parents. The school had a great Rolodex, and we could call parents and use the school's phones. And I tried to keep the ratio of calling home for a bad reason, Jimmy's not working hard enough, to calling home for a good reason. You know, Jennifer did particularly well on a quiz today, and whatever she's doing is working. I tried to keep that ratio at least 1-to-1. And when you call home for a good reason, first of all, you often encounter parents who have never fielded a call from a teacher who wanted to compliment their son or daughter. I would say, hi, this is Mr. Molly. I'm Jeremy's math teacher. And they would go, uh-oh, what did he do? And if your response was, no, I'm just calling to say that he made an astute observation in class today that really surprised me. I think he went out of his comfort zone and he took a risk and made a comment, made an observation that struck me as particularly mature. And I once had a student who wanted to prove me wrong It was a math class, and he got a question wrong on a quiz, and he said, "Mr. Molly, I'm going to prove you wrong tonight." And I said, "Fine, just do it for homework." And I called his mother that night and said, "Your son left class excited to disprove a certain concept in geometry. And I just want to tell you that that excites me to no end. He makes it, he reminds me why I became a teacher. Your son today made teaching enjoyable." And I could tell Rich by the quality of the silence on the other end of the line that she was crying, you know, that no teacher had ever called home. And the thing is that between calling home for a good reason to praise a student and calling home for a bad reason, the good calls, let's call them, are more effective.
Right.
You never know when the bad call is actually going to make something worse. If there's some crazy, violent parent, and it's just going to make things worse for the kid. But calling home for a good reason, they hang up that phone, and they turn, and they look at their son or daughter, and they are beaming, and the kid looks up and goes, "What?" And they're just, you know, they're crying, and they say, "That was your teacher who said you did a good job today." The kid feels great. He doubles down on his homework that night, and he comes in the next day beaming and wanting more of the same.
And, of course, you have parents who will walk through the wall for you, too.
Oh, absolutely, because then if you need to, if that kid is acting out, the next week you can call them up and they're on your side and you can say, "I wanted to murder your son today." And the parents will say, "I can get him in his sleep. I can make it look like an accident." I'm joking, of course, but you're right. They're on your side after that.
Right.
Now, many teachers will say, "I would call home if anybody were there, or if anybody would call me back." And that's important to know. If there's no support system at home for the kid, you as the teacher, you need to know that.
Yeah. My guest today is Taylor Molly, a poet, a former classroom teacher. He's the author of the viral poem, What Teachers Make, which is now a book with the same title, What Teachers Make, in Praise of the Greatest Job in the World. It's published by Putnam. One of the things you talk about is happy accidents and light bulb moments. The story you tell is of, I guess it was a English class, and you were talking about how language evolves. Can you tell us that story?
The vocabulary book that I used in an eighth grade English class had 10 words that we studied every week, and each of the 10 words was, they were grouped by theme, and I remember one was all words that English borrowed from Spanish, like aficionado and siesta. Few others. And the very first chapter was words about words and language. And I remember some of the definitions, some of the words were connotation and denotation. These were going to be useful words for talking about language in the rest of the year. I understand why this chapter was first. And then there were words like jargon and a new word for me, argot.
Argot.
A-R-G-O-T, which is a secret language, such as one used by thieves. A secret language so that people who are part of the same group can communicate with each other without anybody else knowing. The way thieves don't call their victims victims, they might say the mark, right? So that's called the argot, a secret language, especially of thieves. So I asked my students for homework in preparation for the vocab quiz, which was going to be later that week. I said, let's come up with our own slang, our own argot, the secret language of students. So I want you to go home and I want you to come in with 10 phrases that will stand for common everyday school occurrences that don't exist yet. And the example that I gave them was, let's pretend that to get a detention is to shank a D, like, "Oh man, I didn't do my homework, so Mr. Johnson shanked a D on me." You know, that's what I came up with. That was the coolest thing that I could come up with that would mean to receive a detention. I actually much prefer what one of my students came up with the next day. He suggested that to get a detention was to book a one-way ticket to statue class. which I thought was very, very poetic. But what happened, I passed out a piece of paper where they had to come up with these 10 examples of school-related phenomena and their own examples of, you know, what's a phrase that students could use among themselves to mean, you know, these things, like to arrive late for class, to ask to go to the bathroom when you don't really have to oversleep, or to ask for an extension. But the example at the top of the page was to shank a D, which I suggested was new slang that meant to get a detention. Well, the bell rang and they all left. And as always happens, somebody must have left that assignment sheet on their desk. I don't know how they were going to complete the homework. They would have come in the next day and said, I lost the assignment sheet. Anyway, the next teacher to come into the class was this 40-year teaching veteran in his mid to late 60s. And he was teaching a humanities class, and he picked up my assignment sheet, and he almost correctly, he glanced at it and didn't quite catch the point. So he thought that my example, to shank a D, was actually established eighth grade slang for getting a detention. Now, some of the students in his class were students I had just had. Other students came in and were new. So at the end of his class, when he's talking about his own assignment, he just happened to mention, he wanted to try to use the hip new slang
exactly.
that he thought the eighth grade was already familiar with, and said, now, remember, ladies and gentlemen, the essays are due on Monday, and anyone who does not have an essay for me by the end of the day on Monday can expect to shank a D. Now, half the class had no idea what he was talking about, and the other half was wide-eyed and thought, oh my goodness, we only just learned of this phrase 40 minutes ago, and already Mr. Johnson is using it. And does language change that fast? And of course the answer is no, but yes, it does. Language can change almost in the blink of an eye, and that was just a happy accident. And they came in, at least those half-dozen students came in with this great story to tell about how slang had been created right before their eyes.
One of the things you've always tried to do is encourage your students to think for themselves, and you have a great way of engendering skepticism, and I thought this was a great idea. You know, you've been teaching a subject, and so you ask them to comment on an essay that you write in which the facts are utterly wrong.
But they have to sound convincing.
You make a convincing argument of wrong thoughts. You put authority with it because you actually tell who wrote this essay, you know, of, you know, an archaeologist of the Egyptian Museum, I think is the example you use, who says that, you know, religion wasn't important in Egyptian day-to-day life. And you basically encourage the kids to just rip it up or to give their honest reaction. And if they learn the material, they know it's utterly specious and utterly wrong.
Right.
And what a great way to teach.
Thank you. I can't remember who it was who said education has produced a vast populace who knows how to read but cannot tell what is worth reading. So part of your job as a teacher is to teach your students to evaluate arguments on their merit, evaluate sources, and when they don't believe that a thesis has been properly supported or can be properly supported with the facts, you need to politely but systematically point out the errors in somebody else's logic. So I would often, one of the essays when I was teaching history, one of the essay questions that I would put on the test was to respond to an excerpt of a scholarly work, and the students never knew that I had made up both the author and the ridiculous thesis that the author was saying, but I would claim that it came from a certain book, and you know, it's Dr. Sanjay Patel says that, just as you said, religion was actually not very important in ancient Egyptian civilization. Well, even my sixth graders knew that that was wrong. And religion was very important. Religion, if religion was not important in a society, the pyramids would never have been built. And so they would, I stopped teaching just as the internet was becoming really prevalent. Mm-hmm. But so nowadays, I think people are a little bit more leery to you can't trust everything you find on the internet. It's even more important now to question sources. But I thought that was a very useful skill that I should be teaching.
One last question. You know, your subtitle of the book, What Teachers Make, is in praise of the greatest job in the world, and it can be the greatest job in the world. It can be the toughest job in the world. And, you know, I hate to bring this up because, you know, you're living as a poet today and making a living as a poet, which is an accomplishment in and of itself. But, you know, you didn't stay in the classroom. And I think this is a real worry for a lot of people who do value education, is the best and brightest. It's such a tough job. And you write in the book about, you know, it's 12, 14-hour days. It's 7 hours in the classroom, but it's another 7 hours outside of the classroom. What can we do to make this a more respected profession and worth putting in those long hours?
Well, there isn't a day that goes by that I don't miss being in the classroom. I tell myself that for the 12 years that I've been out of the classroom, to a certain extent, I mean, yes, I make a living as a poet, but part of how I make that living is that schools hire me to come in and teach teachers how to teach poetry. I'm an itinerant guest English teacher.
Right.
And last week I was teaching in Qatar at the American School of Doha. I don't think I even knew where Qatar was a couple years ago. It's on the east coast of Saudi Arabia, by the way. So I get to travel the world, and I'm still teaching. There hasn't been a day that hasn't gone by that I haven't been teaching. But what needs to happen, teachers need to do a better job of fighting back and letting people know just how hard their job is. Teachers are not paid as much as other professionals who have similar educational requirements before they can do what they have to do. It's about 22% less. And that 22% would make a difference. You should never be told you're too smart to become a teacher. That still happens all the time, all the time. And often it's other teachers who tell their brightest students, when the student says, you know what, I've decided I want to be a teacher. These jaded teachers say, no, don't do it. Don't become a teacher. You're too smart. Let's start a national conversation about service in America. And President Obama said it in his last State of the Union. He said, I want the best and the brightest to consider teaching. We need them there.
Well, Taylor Molly, we appreciate your time today. Thanks very much for joining us.
My pleasure, sir.
New York City performance poet and former classroom teacher Taylor Molly speaking with us here on Studio Tulsa. His new book and viral poem is titled What Teachers Make, with the subtitle In Praise of the Greatest Job in the World. It's published by Putnam. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.